Alice Feeney's debut novel, Sometimes I Lie, has taken the psychological thriller world by storm, earning praise from Stephen King, who called it a gripping, immersive tale of psychological suspense. The book became an instant Sunday Times bestseller and has been translated into over 20 languages. Its popularity soared when Sarah Michelle Gellar and Ellen DeGeneres announced they were adapting it for television. What makes this thriller particularly compelling is its unreliable narrator and the tagline that haunts readers from the first page. My name is Amber Reynolds. There are three things you should know about me. One, I'm in a coma. Two, my husband doesn't love me anymore. Three, sometimes I lie. With this brilliant hook, Feeney, a former BBC journalist, crafts a story that keeps readers questioning reality until the very last page. Amber Reynolds finds herself in a hospital bed, fully conscious but unable to move or communicate, a medical state known as locked-in syndrome that represents every person's deepest fears. This terrifying state of awareness without expression is brilliantly portrayed through her internal monologue, which becomes increasingly frantic as she realizes her situation. I've always delighted in the free fall between sleep and wakefulness, she tells us, before the horrifying realization hits that she's trapped in her own body. The steady beeping of machines, the squeak of nurses' shoes on linoleum, the casual conversations about her condition, and the complete inability to respond create an immediate sense of claustrophobia that pulls readers into her nightmare. The hospital scenes are particularly effective because they tap into primal fears. Being aware but helpless, hearing others discuss you as though you're not present, feeling the cold touch of latex gloves against skin that can't react. When nurses refer to her as poor love and what a mess, Amber's silent scream of, "My name is Amber Reynolds," highlights her desperate need to assert her identity while being treated as an object. This powerlessness is compounded by the routine indignities of hospital care, being turned, cleaned, and discussed in clinical terms that reduce her to a collection of symptoms and vital signs. The situation becomes even more distressing when her husband Paul visits. Through Amber's heightened awareness, we notice subtle details. The way his cologne seems stronger than usual, how his voice carries an unfamiliar edge, the slight tremor in his hand when he touches her face. She senses something deeply wrong. I can't remember what happened, but I know with unwavering certainty that this man, my husband, had something to do with it. Each visit adds another layer of suspicion, as Paul's behavior oscillates between devoted spouse and something more sinister. The coma becomes a perfect device for exploring truth and deception, serving as both prison and observation post. Amber can only receive information, unable to question inconsistencies or defend herself against accusations and assumptions. When doctors discuss her injuries with Paul, revealing unexplained bruises that predate her accident, we begin to question whether Amber is a victim of abuse or whether something more complex is at play. The medical staff's whispered conversations and Paul's careful explanations create a web of doubt that grows with each passing hour. Her internal world becomes increasingly disturbing as she experiences hallucinations of a little girl in a pink dressing gown singing twisted nursery rhymes. These visions blur the line between memory, dream, and reality, creating a psychological landscape as confining as her physical state. The girl appears during the quiet hospital nights, her songs mixing with the steady rhythm of the heart monitor, leaving readers to wonder whether she's a manifestation of trauma, a recovered memory, or something more sinister lurking in Amber's subconscious. Before her accident, Amber's professional life was unraveling in ways that reveal her darker nature. As co-host of a popular radio show called Coffee Morning, she finds herself threatened with replacement by her colleague Madeline Frost, a rising star known for her sharp wit and growing audience appeal. When her producer Matthew delivers this devastating news during a tense meeting in his glass-walled office, "You're great, we love you, but Madeline is Coffee Morning," Amber's response isn't to improve her performance, but to plot revenge, revealing a fundamental flaw in her character. Her friendship with Joe, initially seeming like casual workplace camaraderie, transforms into a conspiratorial alliance, leading to Project Madeline. Their scheme, meticulously planned over wine-fueled evenings, aims to make Madeline believe she's the one being replaced. This plot reveals Amber's willingness to manipulate and deceive rather than confront problems directly or work on her professional development. When Joe instructs her to buy new clothes and return to work looking confident and carefree, Amber embraces the deception with disturbing enthusiasm, even burning their planning notes in a bar fireplace, ready to color outside the lines for once, a phrase that takes on darker significance as events unfold. The workplace sabotage escalates to shocking levels, executed with calculated precision. Amber creates a fake Twitter account, at Coffee Morning Insider, spreading rumors that Madeline Frost is leaving Coffee Morning with the hashtag FrostBitesTheDust. She carefully times these posts to coincide with important meetings and show recordings. She plants threatening letters among Madeline's papers, each one more unsettling than the last, and ultimately engineers Madeline's downfall through a particularly devious plan, deliberately leaving her microphone on as she makes offensive comments about vulnerable children and pregnant women during what Madeline believes is a private conversation. The calculated nature of this destruction reveals Amber's capacity for patient, meticulous revenge, a trait that becomes increasingly significant as the story unfolds and her true nature emerges. What's particularly disturbing is how Amber justifies her actions through an elaborate system of self-deception. She focuses obsessively on Madeline's flaws, her occasional tardiness, her supposedly fake laugh, her try-hard designer outfits, rather than examining her own behavior or professional shortcomings. When Madeline's career implodes after her offensive comments go live on air, Amber feigns surprise while secretly delighting in her downfall, even comforting Madeline with false sympathy while privately celebrating her victory. This capacity for deception and lack of remorse provides early clues that Amber may not be the reliable narrator she presents herself to be, setting up a pattern of manipulation that extends far beyond workplace rivalry. The entire episode serves as a crucial character study, revealing how Amber's seemingly professional facade masks a deeply manipulative personality capable of sustained deception and calculated revenge. Her actions during this period foreshadow the larger questions about truth and reliability that emerge later in the narrative. Amber's marriage to Paul, a writer she met while working as a TV reporter, appears to be disintegrating under the weight of unspoken tensions and suspicions. Their once promising relationship has devolved into constant arguments, sexual distance, and mutual distrust. When Amber finds black satin lingerie in Paul's wardrobe that's too small for her, she immediately suspects infidelity, particularly with her sister Claire. The marriage is further strained by their inability to conceive a child. This reproductive struggle has pushed Paul toward alcoholism in the past, with Amber recalling how he'd stay up all night in the shed with his laptop and a bottle, writing words that didn't belong together. Their failure to communicate honestly about this pain creates a widening gulf between them, with Paul retreating to his writing shed while Amber obsessively maintains control over their home environment. What makes their relationship particularly intriguing is how both partners withhold crucial information from each other. Amber doesn't tell Paul about losing her job, her pregnancy, or her encounters with her ex-boyfriend Edward. Paul, meanwhile, keeps secrets about his interactions with Claire and his discovery of childhood diaries in their attic. Their marriage becomes a dance of half-truths and omissions, with neither partner fully trusting the other. The complexity of their relationship is captured in a poignant scene where Paul sets up a Christmas tree decorated with ornaments from their travels together. This gesture of love contrasts sharply with Amber's suspicions about his fidelity, creating an emotional dissonance that characterizes their marriage. When Paul later sets up a hidden camera in Amber's hospital room, insisting he knows she's in there, despite what doctors believe, we see both his devotion and his controlling nature, a duality that mirrors the larger themes of the novel. Claire, introduced as Amber's younger sister, brings an immediate sense of unease to the narrative. Described as beautiful and blonde, where Amber is dark-haired, Claire is positioned as the new and improved daughter their parents always wanted. This sibling rivalry takes on sinister dimensions as the story progresses, revealing layers of manipulation and betrayal. The sisters' interactions are charged with tension and unspoken threats. When Claire visits Amber's home uninvited, entering through the back door without waiting to be invited, Amber makes a pointed comment about Claire spending more time with Paul than she has lately. Claire's response, reminding Amber she's only around the corner, feels more threatening than comforting. Their relationship is further complicated by Paul's apparent closeness with Claire, creating a triangle of suspicion and jealousy. As the story unfolds, we learn that Claire isn't actually Amber's biological sister, but her childhood friend Taylor, whose identity Amber stole after a traumatic event. This revelation completely recontextualizes their relationship, explaining the undercurrent of hostility and manipulation that defines their interactions. Claire/Taylor knows Amber's darkest secrets and holds this knowledge over her, creating a power dynamic that extends far beyond normal sibling rivalry. The most chilling aspect of their relationship emerges when we learn that Claire deliberately caused a gas explosion that killed her parents when they were children, claiming she did it for Amber so they could stay together. This act of violence bonds them in a twisted way, with Claire telling Amber, "You should have told me," and "We used to tell each other everything," before deliberately crashing the car on Christmas night, sending Amber through the windshield while pregnant. Their relationship embodies the novel's central themes of identity theft, manipulation, and the dangerous consequences of obsessive attachment. The novel's before sections, presented as diary entries from 1991-1993, provide crucial insights into the formation of Amber's disturbed psychology. These entries, initially believed to be Amber's childhood writings, reveal a deeply troubled young girl struggling with family dysfunction, social isolation, and growing psychological disturbance. The diary writer describes sleeping in her deceased grandmother's bed, finding comfort there despite her mother's offer to redecorate. Her family life is characterized by parental alcoholism, constant arguments, and emotional neglect. "After dinner, I watch TV alone until my mother's alarm signals bedtime at 9. Once I'm in bed, my parents resume arguing. To drown out their fighting, I hum 'The Wheels on the Bus,' a song Nana used to sing." The entries document the writer's growing friendship with Taylor, noting with fascination that they share the same birthday and were born in the same hospital just hours apart. This connection becomes obsessive as the writer envies Taylor's seemingly perfect family life. "I list three things Taylor has that I don't: cool parents, a nice home, and her very own stars." When Taylor introduces her imaginary friend Joe, the writer agrees to borrow Joe to help with loneliness, foreshadowing the blurring of fantasy and reality that characterizes adult Amber's psychology. The most disturbing revelation comes when we learn these diaries actually belonged to Claire, Taylor, not Amber. The final diary entry reveals that Amber, whose real name was Claire, has completely assumed Taylor's identity after the tragic fire, writing, "I have the family I always wanted," calling Taylor's parents Mom and Dad, though Taylor herself is unhappy. This identity theft explains Amber's adult behavior patterns, including her obsessive-compulsive tendencies, her capacity for deception, and her complex relationship with the woman she calls her sister. Edward, Amber's ex-boyfriend from university, introduces another layer of threat to the narrative. Their initial encounter on Oxford Street, after a decade of silence, appears deceptively casual. Edward's unnaturally preserved appearance, as if frozen in time since their university days, serves as the first subtle warning sign. He presents himself as a successful professional who has moved to London with his girlfriend, yet something in his demeanor unsettles Amber. The exchange of business cards and practiced small talk masks a deeper, more sinister reality that will soon emerge. The transformation from chance encounter to nightmare accelerates after Amber agrees to drinks with Edward. She wakes up naked and disoriented in an unfamiliar apartment, her memory fragmented. The true horror unfolds as she explores the space, discovering an elaborate shrine to their shared past and her present. Multiple corkboards line the walls, displaying a disturbing chronology. faded photos from their university years transition into recent surveillance shots. These images capture intimate moments of her daily routine, buying coffee at her regular cafe, entering her workplace, waiting on underground platforms. The methodical arrangement reveals years of calculated stalking, each photo meticulously dated and annotated with details about her movements. The hospital setting, traditionally a place of healing, becomes a theater of terror when Edward's role as a night porter comes to light. His position grants him unrestricted access to all wings, all patients, all hours. He exploits this access to visit Amber's room during the quietest hours, when skeleton crews of staff mean fewer witnesses. During these visits, while Amber lies helpless but conscious, Edward reveals the full depth of his obsession and grievance. His confession about being a former medical student whose career was derailed carries particular weight in this sterile hospital setting, a perverse echo of the professional role he once aspired to. The truth about Claire's involvement adds another devastating layer. Her fabricated complaints to Edward's medical school, crafted to appear as testimonies from multiple female victims, didn't just derail his career, they poisoned his perception of Amber. This revelation reframes Edward's current actions as both revenge and reclamation of control, transforming him from spurned lover to calculated predator. Edward's systematic tampering with Amber's IV drip, adjusting medications to prolong her helpless state, demonstrates the evolution of his obsession from emotional to physically controlling. His technical knowledge from his abbreviated medical training makes him especially dangerous, allowing him to maintain Amber's vulnerability while avoiding detection. This medical manipulation represents the ultimate perversion of care into control, highlighting how thoroughly his obsession has corrupted any genuine feelings he might once have held. As the novel reaches its climax, the carefully constructed layers of deception begin to unravel, revealing shocking truths about Amber's identity and actions. We learn that Amber has been living a life built on lies. She isn't who she claims to be, her relationship with Claire isn't what it appears, and her victimhood is far more complex than initially presented. The most stunning revelation is that Amber was originally named Claire, while her sister Claire was actually Taylor. After the childhood fire that killed Taylor's parents, Amber assumed Taylor's identity and was adopted by Taylor's relatives. This identity theft explains the gold bracelet with their shared birthdate that appears throughout the narrative, a symbol of their twisted connection and Amber's crime of stealing not just a bracelet, but an entire life. Amber's unreliability as a narrator becomes increasingly apparent as we discover she has fabricated relationships and events. Her supposed friendship with Joe, who helped plan Madeline's downfall, is revealed to be entirely imaginary. Joe was Taylor's childhood imaginary friend that Amber borrowed and incorporated into her adult life. This explains Paul's confusion when he tries to contact Joe after Amber's accident, only to learn no such person exists at her workplace. The final sections of the novel deliver the most chilling truth of all: Amber's capacity for calculated violence. 6 weeks after leaving the hospital, she methodically murders Claire/Taylor and her husband David, poisoning their meal and setting up Madeline to take the blame by using her credit card to buy petrol and forging threatening letters. She then adopts their twin children as her own, giving Paul the children he always wanted, while eliminating anyone who knew her true identity. The novel's final twist comes when Amber discovers her childhood bracelet with her birthdate on a tray, evidence that someone knows who she really is, suggesting her web of lies may yet unravel again. This open-ended conclusion leaves readers questioning whether justice will eventually catch up with Amber or whether she'll continue her pattern of deception and violence to protect her stolen identity. At its core, Sometimes I Lie explores profound questions about identity and self-knowledge. Amber's opening statement, "Sometimes I Lie," is both a warning to readers and a confession of her fractured relationship with truth. Throughout the novel, we witness how lies can become so ingrained that they transform into a kind of personal reality for the liar. Amber's identity theft is not merely a plot device, but a metaphor for the human capacity to reinvent ourselves, sometimes at terrible cost. Her childhood diary entries reveal a profound envy of Taylor's life. I couldn't help thinking how different my life would be if I'd been born into Taylor's family instead, with their Volvo and living grandparents. This coveting of another's existence eventually leads to Amber literally stealing Taylor's identity, suggesting that our desire to escape our circumstances can lead to moral corruption. The novel also explores how trauma shapes identity. Both girls experience significant childhood trauma, Amber through parental neglect and alcoholism, Taylor through the deliberate destruction of her family. These experiences create a toxic bond between them that continues into adulthood, with neither able to fully escape their shared past. When adult Claire slash Taylor tells Amber, "You should have told me," about her pregnancy, we see how their twisted expectation of complete transparency persists despite their dysfunctional relationship. Perhaps most disturbing is the novel's suggestion that we can lie to ourselves so effectively that we lose sight of our true nature. Amber consistently portrays herself as a victim of workplace bullying, of her husband's potential infidelity, of Edward's stalking, while concealing her own capacity for manipulation and violence. This self-deception allows her to justify increasingly disturbing actions, culminating in multiple murders that she frames as necessary for her survival and happiness. By the novel's end, we're left questioning whether anyone can truly know themselves or others completely. As Amber observes, we are all children disguised as adults, hiding our true selves behind carefully constructed personas. This unsettling conclusion suggests that identity itself may be a form of fiction, a story we tell ourselves and others that may bear little resemblance to the truth. Feeney's debut novel demonstrates remarkable skill in maintaining suspense through carefully paced revelations and strategic withholding of information. The three-part structure, now, then, and before, creates a disorienting timeline that mirrors Amber's fractured consciousness, forcing readers to piece together the truth from fragments of memory, dream, and deception. This complex chronological weaving serves multiple purposes. It reflects Amber's psychological state, creates narrative tension, and cleverly disguises crucial plot elements that only become apparent upon a second reading. The novel's brilliance lies in how it constantly shifts our sympathies and suspicions. Initially, we fear for Amber as a vulnerable woman in a coma, potentially the victim of her husband's violence. Her helplessness in the hospital bed generates immediate empathy, while Paul's suspicious behavior and Edward's controlling tendencies plant seeds of doubt about their intentions. As the narrative progresses, our suspicions shift to Claire, whose seemingly perfect exterior masks deeper motivations, then to Edward, whose past reveals troubling patterns. Finally, we recognize Amber herself as the most dangerous character of all, a revelation that forces readers to reevaluate everything they've assumed about victimhood and reliability. This kaleidoscopic perspective keeps readers off balance, creating the psychological equivalent of walking on shifting sand. Feeney leaves several questions deliberately unresolved, enhancing the novel's unsettling effect. The mysterious appearance of the childhood bracelet on the tray at the novel's conclusion suggests Amber's carefully constructed new life remains precarious. This single object serves as both a threat and a reminder, carrying the weight of her past deceptions. The fate of Edward after Amber's awakening is similarly unresolved, creating another potential threat lurking in the background. His absence from the conclusion leaves readers wondering whether he might return to expose her lies or seek revenge. These open threads suggest that deception creates not closure, but ongoing vulnerability. Lies require constant maintenance and vigilance, a psychological burden that never truly lifts. The novel's final image, Amber discovering her childhood bracelet with her true birth date, serves as both a warning and a promise. Someone knows who she really is, threatening the identity she's stolen and the family she's appropriated through murder. This unresolved tension creates a powerful commentary on the nature of identity and truth. The bracelet becomes a physical manifestation of her past sins, suggesting that no matter how carefully constructed our facades might be, authentic identity has a way of asserting itself. In this way, Sometimes I Lie becomes not just a thriller, but a moral parable about the inescapable nature of truth and the destructive power of self-deception. The novel suggests that our lies, like ripples in a pond, continue to expand outward long after the initial deception, creating patterns of consequence that can never be fully controlled or contained.